This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon. Unfortunately, Rahul is off today. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the show Larry and Lauren Acker, trial lawyers from the great state of Michigan. So I think you guys are our first Michigan guests. So welcome, guys.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be asked to participate in your podcast program.
Yeah, and you were just reminding me, Larry, that we first met when I was working on a case in federal court in Detroit, and I needed stellar Michigan-based trial counsel to partner with in the case. And we ended up working together in a pretty interesting case where we got a great result for our client right on the brink of trial. And partnering you with was a terrific experience for me. I learned a lot from you. I think we had a great partnership and worked well together. So it just is a really nice reminder of how sometimes in this business, kind of the relationships you make and collegiality is just can be a really nice part of the practice. So thanks for doing that for me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I agree with that sentiment. And I would say the same thing in the opposite direction. I learned a lot from you. I learned how to use 30B6 depositions of institutional party discovery that I had not really thought much about until you and I met. And I was really impressed with what you were able to accomplish by using additional discovery devices that I had not maximized. And then I don't know if you remember, and you probably do, but we had a Michigan-based case that got removed to the SDNY in New York right during COVID. Interesting case involving a New York law firm that had missed some filing deadlines on an NFL claim for the widow of an NFL player. And when it moved to SDNY, we followed the case, but you were instrumental in helping us manage the case in New York. So I learned also from that relationship that having really competent co-counsel in a jurisdiction that you're not familiar with is a necessary asset.
Yeah, no, that was a really interesting case, and I enjoyed being part of it, representing the family of a former running back. As I recall, he played for the Detroit Lions and died with CTE and then was deprived of his opportunity for recovery because the lawyers missed the deadline. So that was a really interesting case. And our other case involving claims against Fiat Chrysler for car testing that they were doing in Colorado was really fascinating because it brought up very interesting issues of member choice of law. And there were motions on whether there was subject matter jurisdiction in federal court based on where the individual was domiciled. And it actually was sort of a crash course in first year civil procedure, which I had hoped to forget, but we had to remember it. And it ended up with summary judgment arguments that we won, which was a real turning point in that case. So, we've worked on two really fascinating cases together. Hopefully there'll be more. So, why don't we talk about you guys? So we have a father-daughter combination here. I don't know if we've had that before on the show. One of you is a slightly more experienced than the other, but you guys are part of a team now that's trying cases together, practicing law together. So Can you guys maybe share with us kind of what your journey is to both of you to becoming trial lawyers and then ending up in this sort of father-daughter team?
Yeah, the question is who starts? And Lauren just pointed her finger at me, so I think I'm up.
We'll go with seniority. How about that?
That's fine. I have been practicing law for 40 years. I had the extremely good fortune that when I was attending law school at the Detroit College of Law, one of my primary professors on civil procedure and torts was a gentleman named Richard Sir Heinrich. He recruited me to practice in his firm. I did not know much about Dick Sir Heinrich's stature, but I was only there a couple of years when he was nominated and successfully appointed to the federal bench, a marvelous lawyer. His partner at the time was a man named Richard Kitch. And Dick Kitch, also unknown to me at the time because I was too much of a neophyte to understand it, Dick Kitch was a fellow in the American College of Trial Lawyers. And I was really fortunate. I think it's true that for many lawyers, your first job determines what you're going to be interested in and what success you might have. And Kitch and Sir Heinrich had a small firm. I think I was the 10th guy in the door. And they were both accomplished trial lawyers. And they considered it their responsibility to teach people how to behave, how to take depositions, how to prepare a case, how to report, how to behave in trial. I was blessed because I tried my first federal court case, first chair, at the six-month mark of my career with Kitch and Sir Heinrich. And it was only because they mentored and tutored people extremely well. And I'm not sure that I would have chosen trial law if I had been sitting in a classroom somewhere and given options. But being exposed to it, when I walked in courtrooms, for some reason, I understood where I should be, how to behave, how to treat people, and how to communicate. And it's continued for 40 years. We are now located in a relatively small town in Michigan, northern Michigan, but we maintain a national practice in what I have specialized in for the last 25 years, which is primarily legal malpractice and accounting malpractice. And we can talk about that a bit, but I still enjoy the courtroom. We successfully tried a case this year. I unsuccessfully tried a case last year. I get one or two a year, and we are set to begin a medical malpractice case in about a week. So still very much active practice and still very much enjoy it.
And you yourself are now a fellow in the American College of Trial Lawyers.
Yes, I am, Ben. And I had the good fortune. I was the chairman of the Michigan State Committee for 2 years, standard tenure is 2 years. And I did that, I think, in 2019 and 2020 and had a great time. The college, as you know, is a tremendous opportunity to meet qualified lawyers, work together, learn from other people, and develop camaraderie with people who practice in a variety of areas and subject matters.
So Lauren, when we were working on that NFL concussion case, you at that time you were in Puerto Rico, but you're back in Michigan now and practicing with your dad, right?
Yeah, that's right. I graduated from law school in 2019 and ended up in Puerto Rico and was looking for work and just kind of exploring all my options. And my dad said to me, you know, hey, I have this project you could help me with. So I did. And then he had another one and same deal. And then finally he said, well, you know, I think I can keep you busy. And so although I hadn't really intended to start practicing with him, it just kind of happened organically. And I worked remotely with him for about 3 years. And then I recently, well, I guess about 9 months ago, moved back to Michigan. And we've been able to practice out of the same office, which has been really wonderful. I can be more actively involved and shadow him, going to different hearings and meetings with clients and depositions. And so it's been a great opportunity. And as he mentioned, we had our first trial together. And that was, of course, my first trial in May. And that was a great experience.
Can you tell us a little bit about that trial?
Yeah, it was an accounting malpractice case. And it was a long time coming. I think Larry had gotten the case in 2018, and I started working with him on it in 2019 or early 2020. And with the COVID delays, you know, it only went to trial a couple months ago. It was a fairly complex case with where an employee had embezzled at least about $3.5 million from a corporation, and they later discovered it and then sued their accountants for failing to discover it despite, you know, several opportunities over the decade plus that the embezzlement was occurring. So that was kind of the baseline of the case.
Were you retained by the company to bring the case against the accounting firm? Is that how that worked?
Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were initially hired just to investigate what had happened without any real motivation other than just trying to figure out what went wrong.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And I shortly recognized after I became involved that the employee was a bookkeeper, but the corporation employed outside accounting services from the same firm for a period of 25 years. And accounting malpractice cases are interesting because the AICPA standards, to a greater degree than is true in other types of malpractice case, really do set forth what is expected behavior and how the accountants are supposed to perform. And they write very tight engagement letters that define what they are required to do and how to do it. I didn't initiate the investigation thinking that we would find a road to the accountants. I thought we would find a road to trying to recover from the employee that embezzled. And it turned into an accounting malpractice case that was not obvious, but required a lot of work. Paper intensive. Lauren's computer and organizational skills really helped us. We worked with a forensic accountant and his assistant, who is a trained fraud investigator. And we eventually figured out exactly how the embezzlement had been accomplished. We wound up having to give the prosecutor and the investigators at the state level our information to help them prosecute the embezzler. And they did. And he went to a federal prison for about 3 years. But it took a lot of development, but it was a very interesting case.
And your case ultimately was against the accounting firm for missing what red flags or signs that should have alerted them to this scheme?
Yes, correct.
So, and I'm interested in this, probably a lot of our listeners may own their own firms or be involved in managing their own law firms. So that's something we have to be concerned about in running our own businesses, is this idea of the possibility of embezzlement of money. It seems to be happening more and more these days in different sectors. And then having appropriate controls with your internal bookkeeping and outside accounting services to catch that based on your own career in doing accounting and malpractice cases. Do you have advice for lawyers who own or manage law firms on what they should be doing to protect themselves?
Yeah, I sure do. I have never personally worked in a large corporate environment, and I think the larger law firms that engage a CFO or a CEO do a better job of developing their procedures and practices to avoid embezzlement. But some of the really basic ones, even small firm environments, can benefit from. So generally speaking, there should be only one set of books. It should be maintained by somebody who is assigned the task of keeping the books. So that means receiving funds, making deposits, accounting for them, keeping the general ledger, and then issuing payments to vendors and to clients out of the client trust accounts. But that person should not have the ability to sign the checks that are issued and should not have the ability to be the only person accessing the books and records. So one of the owners of a firm has to routinely look at the general ledger, and now with internet banking, we all have access to it, to just watch the ebb and flow of where money is coming from and where it's going to. I have in the past represented a law firm who suffered a large embezzlement from their client trust account attributable to an employee who was herself a CPA. And fortunately, I was able to recover money in that case against her as well. But the same kinds of techniques that make common sense. If you employ an outside accounting firm, that's great, but you should have an audit on a standard schedule every 2 years or every 5 years from yet another firm who comes in to say, your practices make sense, you're not suffering any outlier behavior that would suggest anybody's doing something incorrect. If the firm permits anybody to write checks by hand, there's got to be a method for accounting for that, and there has to be a rule about two signatures. And I guess the final thing I would say is banks are interested in avoiding fraud because they are exposed as well. I've successfully prosecuted cases against banks that should have recognized embezzlement based upon the size of the checks were being issued and to whom they were being written, and that the signatures deviated from the signature cards at the bank. So bankers currently, if you have a good relationship with a banker, they are interested in helping you set up procedures and helping you monitor what happens. It's really easy in a busy practice to assume everything is going well and fail to take the time to check it with professionals helping you check it.
Yeah, and especially with a plaintiff's practice, there's enormous amounts of cash flow in and out with case costs and all the vendors and experts and all of that. For instance, in that last case or in the law firm case you had, what are the like schemes that you see employed to embezzle money?
In the case that we tried, where the embezzlement total was $3 million, and for a variety of reasons, we recovered about $750,000 from the accounting firm. There were some offsets related to insurance and other parties that were also deemed to be responsible. But the primary method in that case is that the corporation operated ships that travel on Lake Michigan and in the Great Lakes. And under the category of marine insurance, the bookkeeper was writing checks to himself, which he was crediting to marine insurance. And under AICPA standards, with a financial review procedure that was supposed to be accomplished, when the marine insurance category continued to rise, they had red flags, but they never asked to match up the issued checks with policies. They didn't look at the checks as they were cleared to see to whom they had been paid. And they never went back to the insurance agent or the executive in the company who was responsible for purchasing insurance to say, do these numbers make sense to you? So generally, checks are written in a bogus way to the person who's depositing the money. It will not make sense. In the law firm case where the money was being withdrawn from the client trust account, that was an issue of simply the same person who was responsible to write checks and issue them had authority to sign them, and then she was the same person who at the end of the month received the canceled checks and reconciled the accounts. The law firm was a pretty big firm and very prosperous, personal injury firm, doing very well. They simply did not enact a procedure internally to have one of the partners look at the canceled checks every month to see if they were going to the expected recipients.
Either of you have an accounting background?
I do not.
I don't either.
Do you have facility with the numbers and spreadsheets and things to the point where you can kind of look at that? And I find when I look at numbers and graphs, I sort of have this eye glaze factor and I'm good at reading narrative, but when it comes to try to gleaning something from a table, I find it more difficult. Are you able to do that, or do you have to bring in experts to assist you in understanding the numbers?
Well, I share the same disability that you described. My eyes glaze over also, but I have learned. Primarily what I have been successful with is that when I developed a referral base where people understood that I was willing to handle accounting malpractice cases, I had the very good fortune of meeting a forensic accountant with whom I now have worked for 20 years, a guy who will look at things informally with me without cost. But I filter the records initially and say, this doesn't look right to me based upon experience. What do you think? And I get his feedback. And then if you think you have something worthy of investigation, he employs a forensic investigator who will go through all the paperwork. And in the case that we're describing where we did recover the verdict, I would also credit Lauren with working very closely with the forensic investigator. Between the two of them, they put together tables that made difficult financial reports understandable to lay people. And we used those charts that were made by Lauren in the trial on the screen to show the jury where the money went. It was a convoluted path, but once you understood it, you could explain it and people readily understood it. When they determined in the jury verdict form the amount of money that had been stolen, it basically was an acceptance of our figure without question. We told them what it was. We walked them through the process. They agreed with our number in the jury verdict form.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
And how do you keep the jury's interest in a case like this? I mean, when obviously the personal injury cases where you have devastating personal losses and injuries, although sometimes we don't have the economic figures as clear as what you have in an accounting case, there's usually a fairly compelling human story, which it sounds like may not be present. It's sort of a business lost money from accounting malpractice. How do you get the jury to be interested and care about a case like that?
I think for this case, we were lucky. There was an element of human interest just by virtue of the fact that it took place in a very small town, and this company was a large employer within the small town, and people were very familiar with the company generally and its story. And so we got lucky in that sense that the community was engaged, at least to a certain extent, and it was an 8-day trial. So I do imagine it was dry, and we had the bailiff tell us as much throughout the trial. But ultimately, people listened, and I think having graphics and stuff like that helped, and they followed along quite well. So it was dry and complex, but they came with us. I don't know if you have something else to add.
Yeah, the one thing I would add is that Lauren's correct. It was personal to the people who lost the money because ultimately the assets of the company had to be sold. And everybody in town knew that, and a number of people lost their jobs as a consequence. So it was a community that was affected by the embezzlement and knew about it. The owners of the business were interesting gentlemen. They were pretty charismatic in their own right, and they personalized it. When they were trying to clean up, sometimes you get lucky, as you know, Ben, with the way witnesses behave. When the company was trying to clean up the aftermath of the embezzlement, they hired a young woman who came in, was smart, recently graduated, CPA, qualified, and she reassembled their books and records. And in the process, she worked with the FBI agents and gave them all the tables that they used to convict the embezzler. She was a delight to work with. She was humorous. She was a vivid personality. We called her very early in the case to help set the stage that this is not just money. These are real people. And here's the person who came in and helped clean it up. What's it like to communicate with the FBI? How is it that you were so skillful the FBI came to rely upon you? And so that was very helpful.
So Lauren, having gone through that experience, and obviously you guys got a great result and the jury awarded exactly what you requested for damages, what are your takeaways from that experience, from that trial that you're going to carry forward to the practice and, you know, the next trial?
Well, personally, given that it was my first trial, I learned kind of how I respond in that setting, how I feel anxiety and when, and how that translates and how to manage that. I guess surprised at some points to feel like I was actually having fun. but My dad and I had a conversation about this because I didn't know if this was a normal experience or if every case follows a different pattern, I'm sure. But the momentum swings felt like we were on a roller coaster. Some days really felt like they went our way, and other days just felt like a gut punch. And I didn't know if that was a common experience. And so we had a conversation driving home one day after on a weekend break during trial. And from Larry's experience, he said that wasn't all that common. But it was a really interesting learning experience for me to just be in the courtroom really for the first time and making observations about how a trial feels and how it unfolds. And we had a really great judge. I think that facilitated my experience as well. She explained everything, and I think she did a really great job managing all the attorneys, opposing counsel. And my dad had some disagreements that she was managing behind the scenes, and I got to go back and observe that as well. Which, of course, I'm sure for most of your audience, these are all things that are just very common. But just for someone with fresh eyes, those were the takeaways that I was grateful to be able to observe in a way where, well, it was low pressure for me, and I could really just be supportive.
My daughter is 15. She'll be 16 next month, which she's very excited about because she's going to finally get her driver's license. But she's now talking about wanting to be a lawyer someday. And so we joke around about how she'll take over the practice. And you know, but it would be such a dream come true, I think, someday to be able to practice with her. I have two sons, but neither of them are interested in the law. And that's probably a good thing, too. But so, Larry, after 40 years of trying cases, what's it like to try a case with your daughter?
Well, yeah, we did have a very good time. It was no less stressful than other cases I have tried, and it was certainly not an easy case. And you kind of...
Was it more stressful because you were trying to impress your daughter?
No,
or
I got
felt
past
the burdens of her being there and watching. Was that, did that create a source of additional stress for you?
No, I would say no. I have mentored other young lawyers and tried cases with people who it was their first event. And the one thing that I did say to Lauren, and I believe this to be true, regardless of who the junior attorney might be or and how experienced they are, I think the message that you want to convey as a trial lawyer is, I'm genuinely interested in your feedback. I can't hear everything. I can't see everything that happens in the courtroom. I sometimes say things inadvertently that I don't really intend, and they're taken the wrong way, or they could be taken the wrong way because they're ambiguous. I want to know that. And if you have a reaction, if you think I've beaten too hard on a witness and it's time to quit, I want to know that. And I will never criticize you for offering your opinion. I may disagree with you. We may have a discussion about how that issue should be approached. But Lauren did a very good job of paying attention to language and the age of our jurors, and sometimes said to me as we were talking in the evening with a witness or preparing examination, she would say, quite honestly, I don't think you should phrase it in quite that manner, and I think we should be more careful in our choice of language. And I changed my use of some words, and I followed her direction. I also think what younger people bring to the table currently is tremendous legal research and internet research skills. I had access, because of Lauren and because of the young forensic investigator we worked with, to some information about embezzlement and accounting practices that I would never have discovered on my own independently. So I think the message to those of us who think we are experienced is you can always benefit from fresh eyes and somebody else who's paying attention, possibly interpreting things differently than you do, and having the moxie to speak up and tell you we got to think this through.
When you look back on your career trying cases, and I know you've tried a lot of cases over the years, are there specific cases that were turning points for you or that you remember as being particularly significant in the course of your career trying cases?
Yeah, there are. And I have a couple that come to mind. The first 10 years of my practice, I was primarily a medical malpractice defense attorney in a fairly large firm. We had in the neighborhood of 20 people. And I had not handled a legal malpractice case, and I really wasn't familiar with them. But one of the guys in our office was an appellate lawyer. A different firm had brought in a case. There had been an early summary disposition on pleadings in a legal malpractice action, and it was reversed on appeal. The case came back to us, and the firm that had handled it initially decided it was politically incorrect for them to continue with a legal malpractice action. It was relatively simple. A lawyer had been charged with obtaining zoning renewals and zoning qualifications for a large mobile home project that was to be built on a piece of property. He didn't do it correctly. They lost the opportunity to do it. The developer lost the access to the property. And when the case came back from the Court of Appeals and it circulated around the firm and nobody wanted it, I said, I'll take it. I'm a lawyer. I try cases. I like being in trial. If the man made a mistake, he's accountable. Let's deal with it. I tried the case. I got a verdict. I think it was $1.5 million. And for that, the county at the time, that was a very large verdict. And my name quickly circulated in the courthouse as somebody who was willing to look at legal malpractice. So that one stands out in my mind. That was clearly a case where a lawyer made a mistake and somebody has to hold him accountable. I've had others that were pretty interesting along that line. For a period of time in Michigan, the circumstances under which you could collect in a divorce action from a husband who failed to disclose assets or a wife who failed to disclose assets or hid assets, after a year that the judgment had been in place, you basically were without a remedy. I had two cases where the husband had defrauded the wife. One of them was pretty significant. I located the property in upstate New York. It was after the period of time that her judgment had aged beyond a year, and I convinced the Court of Appeals that they should reopen that based upon fraud in the inducement to enter into the separate contractual settlement agreement that they had reached. So I was really proud of that case. It was both an appellate accomplishment. And then I tried the case and I got a $3.2 million verdict against the husband. Turns out he owned some apartment complexes in upstate New York that he was putting on his financial records personally, but not disclosing in the divorce. And I quickly had two or three like that, tried a few of them, won them all. And that turned into a cottage industry for a while until the courts changed the timing rules and made it easier for spouses. We have mandatory disclosure of assets, and there are penalties if you don't disclose assets in a divorce context.
So following that initial legal malpractice case that you had success in, probably word spread that you were willing to do legal malpractice, and I know you, a big portion of the work you do is legal malpractice. I guess first question on the legal malpractice, do you ever feel like you get the cold shoulder from the bar because you're perceived as someone who's going after our own, maybe being disloyal to other lawyers, or do people view that as being a necessary and positive self-policing mechanism where the lawyers that aren't meeting their obligations, their clients are being, you know, held to task? How has that been perceived or by the bar and your colleagues?
Well, I have been asked that question in the past by other people. And I would say I do not feel like an outsider. As I told you, I have served as the local state chairman of the American College of Trial Lawyers. I was managing legal malpractice cases when I was nominated and confirmed for the American College of Trial Lawyers. My reputation in that regard has been one that I protect in the sense I don't take frivolous cases. I've never lost a case on the basis that it was frivolous or unfounded. I research them thoroughly. I make sure I have experts available before I file the case. I always work with lawyers who are well respected as potential expert witnesses. And once it became known I was willing to handle them, the state bar has appointed me from time to time as counsel, as special counsel to investigate. I've done work for the Character and Fitness Committee of the State Bar of Michigan. I always tried to make sure that it was a practice that was being conducted professionally and not a practice that took advantage of insignificant errors or insignificant mistakes. I'm not easily offended by lawyer behavior, but I think it's one of those items where most qualified lawyers who are experienced will identify that a lawyer has made a mistake. And in fact, I thought a little bit about legal malpractice today beforehand. And the one thing I would caution people is that I think the mistake most lawyers make who find themselves defending a malpractice case is that they themselves recognize the mistake. And then instead of seeking help for themselves and the client early and for their firms, they try to push it under the rug. It's a communication issue. It's a self-recognition issue. I do, from experience, know that for some lawyers who make a mistake, even an egregious mistake, it takes them a year of litigation to finally acknowledge it and be prepared to resolve it. But for people who practice at a high level of professionalism, we know when, if you've missed a deadline with the court, you can't gloss over it. You've got to go to the court and confess appropriately, identify that the outcome shouldn't be harmful to your client. Don't refuse to accept our position because the lawyer made a mistake. And the client needs to know. So if they need to seek additional counsel or you need to seek counsel, do it early. And I also think that in some small law firms, the lawyers who are not managing the firm don't know that within their professional liability insurance coverage, there are claims management opportunities. Insurance companies will appoint somebody. I've done it myself. I had a problem with a lawyer who accused me of unethical behavior. We clearly didn't agree on what had transpired. I notified my carrier. I asked them to appoint a lawyer, and I also hired for myself an ethicist to review what had occurred. So if there was a problem, I wanted to correct it. If I was correct in how I had behaved, I wanted the endorsement of qualified people. So what I see as a practitioner in this area is the biggest drawback is people who don't tell their clients they have a problem. I'm an expert witness in a case currently, defending a lawyer who thought he missed a statute of limitations, and he did for the jurisdiction where he thought the case had to be presented. And it turned out he didn't understand jurisdiction well enough to know that there were ways to keep the case alive if he filed in a different jurisdiction. Fortunately, his defense lawyer identified that and helped get the client to someone else who would do it.
So if you find yourself in hot water or you think you've made a mistake that opens you up to exposure or claim, first step is you'd want to talk to somebody about that and also disclose what happened to the client right away. So there's complete communication, it sounds like. What have you seen are kind of the areas that are most subjects of attorney malpractice that result in lawsuits that you might end up bringing? Is it mostly missed deadlines, or are there other things that you're seeing as well?
I think it's primarily missed deadlines, and they come in two categories. People in practice areas like medical in the state of Michigan and medical in some other jurisdictions, there are hurdles that have to be satisfied before you are permitted under the statutory scheme to start the case. People make mistakes about timing on those issues, and they will wind up missing the statute of limitations as a consequence. Some of those are uncorrectable. And so I think that can happen even with experienced people, but most often it happens to medical malpractice lawyers who don't specialize in medical malpractice cases. That's a big area of concern.
When you have a case like that, then you end up having to also prove the case within the case. So you have to prove the malpractice case in addition to the legal malpractice case?
Yeah, you do. That's right. And I don't know of any jurisdictions where that's not an accurate presentation. Yes, you have to be able to work up the medical case as well. I think the other area where people do make significant mistakes is meeting discovery deadlines, particularly in federal court. And I don't know if that's a consequence. I haven't met anybody practicing law that I thought was not prepared to satisfy deadlines. It's a question of controlling your diary, your personal behavior, getting help from your partners, and simply making sure that you do things on time. There are some deadlines in some cases that can be fatal if you don't satisfy them.
What are you seeing when you get a legal malpractice case to trial? For instance, if you have a missed deadline in a medical malpractice case. So you're trying the missed deadline case, and then you also have to prove that had they not missed the deadline, they would have succeeded in winning the malpractice case. So you're trying both of those cases. Are there ways in which that's harder than just trying the medical malpractice case alone? Or would you say that's easier because your target now is a lawyer who's missed a deadline rather than the doctor who's made a mistake?
I tend to think that the case against the lawyer is an easier claim because I think it's generally accepted that physicians in our society are highly regarded by the community and garner respect from jurors as a consequence. And in a situation where medical malpractice has in fact occurred, it's unusual in my experience to have a physician admit it. I have had, in the legal malpractice context, been able to get a friendlier situation with the physician and have the physician community basically acknowledge that it was a medical malpractice mistake. The doctor doesn't personalize it to the same degree. The experts don't personalize it to the same degree. And it is easier to dislike a lawyer if you're sitting on a jury than it is to dislike the local doctor.
And are you finding that's consistent with what you're finding the reaction of jurors is to claims against lawyers, that when you're in that courtroom, you can feel that you're kind of starting a little bit ahead of the curve as opposed to that feeling you get when you start trying a malpractice case, that you're starting out in a little bit of a hole that you have to dig yourself out of before the jury's willing to listen to what you have to say?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And if you're in a situation like I was describing earlier, where the lawyer made a concerted effort for 3 months or 6 months to avoid having the client learn about the mistake, you start out at a higher level of appreciation by lay jurors that, at a minimum, the lawyer owed the client the obligation to give them information early and accurately and let them make their own decisions.
Do you follow a particular philosophy or approach to cross-examining the lawyers, whether it's at deposition or trial?
Well, that's a tough question. I make a genuine effort to understand what an attorney has done in his practice and his areas of specialty. And in my investigation, even before I file cases, I try to find out if this event is an outlier for that lawyer, or if it is a function of somebody trying to practice in an area of specialty where they don't have the qualified experience. That makes a difference in my thinking to whether it's a one-off mistake from a guy who's really otherwise a very good lawyer, and then I approach it differently, as opposed to somebody who's swimming in water that he's unaccustomed to, and his mistake is really having failed to refer the case or acquire a relationship with another lawyer who's better qualified to handle that type of case at the inception. So my philosophy is primarily to understand why the lawyer made the mistake, and is it truly an error, an omission of taking care of that client, or is it a practice that you can recognize that the particular defendant engages in frequently? And unfortunately, there are some people who are, I think recidivist is the wrong word, but there are people that I've had multiple cases against the same law firm for basically the same event and recovered significant sums of money. Maybe the lawyer is a tremendous business getter and his partners don't want to disrupt the flow of financial business, so they look the other way on mistakes that he makes or carelessness or a drug or alcohol issue. That type of background is important when you investigate the case.
So you mentioned you guys are starting a trial on September 26th, which is about a week, a little bit over a week away. Tell us what that case is about, Lauren.
It's a medical malpractice case. Have not been super involved in it until now, but a patient was in surgery for a total knee replacement and her popliteal artery was severed. She had to receive massive amounts of blood transfusions, and her recovery, of course, was much different than the expected outcome. She ended up with a lot of nerve damage and required a TENS unit to help manage that nerve damage and pain. And so that's the basis of that case. And luckily, we only have to prove one case rather than a case within a case.
What jurisdiction or venue will that be tried in?
We'll be here in Traverse City.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. And so given that you guys now work together, does that impair your relationship outside of work, that Lauren, you try to avoid Dad because, you know, if you end up having him over for dinner, he's going to like berate you about the research or work on the last case? Or do you guys find a way to like get out and do stuff where you can relax and not chat about work?
Yeah, Well, I don't feel any concern when he calls, so that's good. And we do spend a lot of time together outside of work. I mean, it's great to be able to talk every day and to share a common language and just kind of day-to-day events that we can keep tabs on each other. For the most part, if I'm up in my parents' house, sometimes it'll come up, but sometimes we set specific time to talk on the weekends. Sometimes it just will go for a walk and it's a natural point of conversation. And other times we do a good job of just focusing on family things. And we spend time together not focused on the law. So over Labor Day weekend, we raced together in a sailing regatta. And our cases never came up once that weekend. I think that might have been a record.
I would think sailing in a race would be the kind of thing that you'd have to have all of your focus on. So it would be a nice distraction from the law. Well, I really appreciate you guys joining me. Lauren, from working with your dad just on those two cases, I can say I feel like you're extremely lucky to have him as a mentor and to learn from him. And it seems like...
Yeah, I feel very fortunate.
The reverse is also true. I saw the value you brought to the case we worked on together, Lauren, and all the information and research you did that added enormously to that. So I'm sure it's a very good symbiotic relationship. And I wish you guys really great success. If our listeners have questions about any of the areas that we've discussed today and want to reach out and get a hold of you guys, how do they do that, Larry?
I'd be delighted to answer any questions. My email address is l.acker, which is spelled A-C-K-E-R, at ackerpc.com. And the best phone number is area code 248-229-1911.
Great. Well, thanks again.
Thank you, Ben.
Ben, this has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.